I'm Bill Teeple, and I'm here with Alan Cobb and Donna Colby, and this is Icon Art Radio. So Donna, you started the last show off with a quote from Kandinsky that you had collected doing this color class that you're doing. I'm just fascinated with the color class you're doing. I want to hear more about it. But now you have another Kandinsky quote. Let's hear that one.
Yes, and this one is so charming, I think, and it kind of reveals sort of a different but similar quality as the last week's Kandinsky quote. He's reflecting on his first experience as an artist when he was a young boy. He says, "When I was 13 or 14, I bought a paint box with oil paints from money slowly saved up. The feeling I had at the time, or better, the experience of the color coming out of the tube is with me to this day. A pressure of the fingers and jubilant, joyous, thoughtful, dreamy, self-absorbed, with deep seriousness, with bubbling roguishness, with the sigh of liberation, with the profound resonance of sorrow, with stubborn self-control, with sensitive unstableness of balance, came one after another these unique beings we call colors. Each alive in and for itself, independent, endowed with all necessary qualities for further independent life, and ready and willing at every moment to submit to new combinations, to mix among themselves and create endless series of new worlds." Was he meant to be an artist or what?
Yeah, or a writer.
First experience to, yeah, I mean, true, his expressions in words are just as marvelous as his paintings.
But even more so, the state of consciousness he's in to be able to feel and think and express himself that way about living in this world.
Mm-hmm.
That's inspiring.
And the angle of having that much awe and reverence over your art materials that you're working with, you know, the tubes of paint that he, you know, it wasn't even just the colors that in themselves, but the paint, the swirls of paint coming out of the tubes, and how they were serving him. They were offering themselves to him to combine and play with in his way to create something entirely new. The whole concept is so delightful.
It reminds me of T.H. White's Once and Future King, the first volume where King Arthur is just a boy, and everything is alive, and everything has a mind of its own, and everything is doing its thing, and in an independent manner. It's really, you know, Disney or some studio made an animation of it, which it kind of captures the definition of what's going on in the book. But when you read it, it really is magic.
What I remember the most from that book is the Merlin part, when he's a young boy and Merlin takes him under the water, you know, like all these inner journeys.
He flies with the geese in the sky.
Yeah, to experience the subtle aspects of nature in all these ways. So
I think that's one of the greatest books in the English language.
Yeah, it's really great.
But this place that, I still am coming back to what you were just saying and what you just read. I think that artists, it's almost unique to artists, this love affair that they're experiencing with the world of the senses. I mean, and this is such a great example of that degree of infatuation and devotion that he's feeling about every speck in front of him. And then the art materials, the potential of combination and creation that's there in his hands. I mean, it's really expressed well in this, and it moves me deeply because it reminds me of my own experience and my own feeling about the art studio and the art supplies. Just going to an art store is like
overshadowing
being in a candy shop.
I have such reverence for the paints that I almost can't ever use them.
Yeah, I know it.
Yeah. Well, What I'm discovering too is my own process in the studio is becoming more this inner desire to celebrate the act of creation that's found in all of nature in my own way.
Right.
And somebody was looking at the last three paintings that I did, this friend of mine who always has very profound observations about life in general, and he said, what it seems is happening to you is that you are operating on the level that the little nature spirits probably operate on when they're creating the color of a flower or something like that. Well, just with this delight of, let's see what happens if we put some red lines in the middle here. How about if we put some yellow spots on here, you know, just like in the initial process of creating all of the elements of nature, there's some playfulness that seems like probably took place and is continually taking place as things in nature evolve. And so when he made that comment about my painting process, it just absolutely rang a bell in my mind, because I hadn't really thought about it that way, but that was exactly what I felt like in the studio when I would be applying these colors. Just, you know, just let's try this. But it wasn't a mental let's try this. It wasn't something like, oh, maybe red would look good next to this color. It was more, let's see what happens when.
And I think this is what happens when artists mature, when an artist comes to a mature level of expression, mm-hmm. and they finally figured out how to get out of the way, how to get their brain and their governing factors and all their identities and their attachments and all of these things that are individual sort of step back. And then you're watching through yourself the play of nature herself, mm-hmm. as she designed the flowers and everything else.
Which is probably what Kandinsky meant in that quote we read last week about how he felt like he was talking about the relationship between being an artist and the processes in nature, and how there was no competition involved. How if you tried to completely replicate nature or put into your paintings all the awe that you felt in the presence of nature, it was a hopeless task. But when you were satisfied with just being in the role of an artist for what that was, there was pure joy in both nature and art. And I think this is the key here, that yet you're operating from those same principles as nature, but it's a different thing.
And some people never get there. I mean, I think it's a point of education. I think it's probably the most important point of education that ICON has to offer, is this understanding. Because everyone has kind of the wrong idea about what making art is and expressing oneself. And it's the ability to slip into that place where you are creative intelligence itself, being itself.
Yeah. And it's an interactive thing with all of our life too. Like last week when we read the quote of Kandinsky's experience when he was walking through the streets of Moscow, which was early in his career when he was mesmerized by all the colors and all that. And then even at that time he loved music, but later on he had more of this connection with music and art. And then later at the very end of his career he discovered the world, the microscopic world. He actually like got to look at things through a microscope, and all of his paintings towards the end of his life are his playful take on microscopic life. They actually look like little cells and, you know, invisible kind of creatures, yeah. and everything dancing all over the canvas, but in the colors that he felt when he was thinking about that form of nature, that form aspect of biology. They are just as delightful and just as successful as the paintings where he was more relating to music. They're all abstract, but there's no coldness in his paintings at all. They're warm and loving, and just they embrace you. And you feel like you have a personal relationship with those forms and colors in his paintings.
Well, there's something that happens when you can drop all the dross, you know, get clean, and it's just pure. There's a sort of alchemical thing that goes on in the studio over 20 or 30 years where the dross is drawn off and then you have pure gold. And it has to do with none of that stuff that's hanging on and getting in the way and pulling at that pure expression. But it's just blue and red, and what that is, and delighting in that, and then you're like orchestrating all of these things, for like a conductor giving a performance for the audience, and it's like, isn't this wonderful, and isn't this wonderful, and isn't this wonderful, and isn't this wonderful, and look at what that is, and is that pure. And I guess I'm making the case for modernism again, which is what I'm always doing in this postmodern era, because I think that's what it's all about, this pure language.
Well, they were, at those artists at the beginning of the 20th century, were very much desirous of going more deeply into life. I mean, that was the whole point. Cubism was all about looking at life from many angles simultaneously. And Picasso felt like you couldn't possibly separate yourself from nature. No matter how abstract your art was, there had to, for it to have life to it, it had to be sparked from something in nature, and the desire to go more deeply into the subtler levels of whatever that was. But he was a great example. Picasso was a great example of this process you were just talking about in the studio. In fact, they had to like grab paintings away from him in order for them to have something for Kahnweiler, his dealer, to sell, because otherwise he would just keep painting over top of the same, you know, he's done with that. It's an old image, no interest in that anymore. And now let's do this, let's change it this way. And he didn't really. Occasionally, I think he would reach a point where he would say, that's done, and put it aside. But his tendency was to just not really care about the finished product. It was all in this magic of the moment.
And it was done when the process was done, and it had nothing to do with where the image happened to be at that moment.
Right, yeah.
I think that, you know, film of Picasso painting and overpainting and overpainting and overpainting is very instructive to observe, to think about how that could apply in the rest of a person's life. Mm-hmm. That, you know, there aren't any finished products. It's not a matter of leaving a trail of finished products behind. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of building on things forever. And you stop building on one thing, and other people can call it a finished product, but it really is just preparation for the next thing, which happens to be on a different canvas and with different colors.
Mm-hmm. And then that's why I think the seasons, the changes of the seasons, it's a good metaphor for life rather than this linear kind of picture.
Well.
Because I'm thinking about that when I went for my walk this morning, and looking at the autumn colors and all of that, and the leaves falling from the trees. And I thought, well, here I am in my 60s, which is what I would consider the autumn of my life. And what does that mean in terms of the seasons? And I thought, wow, that's really cool, because what happens in the autumn is harvest time, for one thing. And so it feels to me like this is a time in my life when all the stuff has been growing and growing and growing. A lot of it is being harvested and consumed, and you know, something is being done with that. And also the big display that nature does in the fall, where the leaves are about to die and fall off the tree, but before they do that, they have this magnificent display of these glorious colors that are full of life. And that to me also is appropriate to this period of the being on the older edge of middle age. It feels like a time of celebration of all that's come before and a time to revel in all that I've learned and all that I am capable of doing now and all the people I know and so forth. And the, also the leaves are dropping from the trees, and that was seemed also appropriate. Like it's a time of letting go of many old attachments and things that like grip you and hold you fast and you think are highly important and you can't live without them, and you're finding that that's not so true anymore. So it was a it was just a nice way of looking at the cycle of growth. And when in nature, you know, at the end of winter, there's always spring again. So for our picture of life, too, it's a good thing to keep in mind that there's never an end, really.
Also, when we were talking about one of the ways in which music brings pleasure, in that music is full of patterns that repeat, and recognizing something that's familiar is pleasurable. Mm-hmm. And the you know this it's even has the same you know neurophysiological signature as the aha response or the contentment of a nursing infant, and all those things come out during the you know in a sort of microscopic form and during the experience of recognition. Mm-hmm. And music provides an opportunity for many layers of different kinds of recognitions to be happening over and over again, both in terms of the meter, where you recognize that it's still in the same meter within fractions of a second, and melody, where you discern the structure of the melody and you hear it repeating over and over, and the chord structure is repeating and the orchestration is repeating. And if it's in sonata form, then you see this larger structure which is repeating with subtle variations that are intrinsically interesting because they're not perfect repetitions. And sometimes on the symphonic scale, the sonata form has, you know, tremendous satisfaction in the final movement where all the themes get recapitulated and wound back together again and stuff. Well, you know, the year is really the largest scale pattern that we have available to us to recognize. Mm-hmm. There isn't quite anything bigger than that. We don't recognize lives because we're not allowed to remember anything before this one. So that cycle of the seasons is kind of the largest melody available to us. And there is a, you know, when you can see that, it gives your pattern recognizing brain this kind of wonderful huge stretch, because you can look at an entire year of life as being an element that you know.
That was so cool, because when you were talking about both of those things, about the music, you know, and all of the play of the notes and everything, and the elements of the seasons and the cycle of the year, it related directly back to the quote that we started off with, where Kandinsky was talking about his experience with the tubes of paint, mm-hmm. and how each color came out independent in and of itself, willing to be combined in any possible way for myriad kinds mm-hmm. of combinations. And that's exactly what happens in music. It's the same scale, the same notes that are through the centuries have been combined in unbelievable number of ways mm-hmm. to create all these pieces of music. And it's the same thing that makes years, the cycle of years, different from one another. Yeah. We go through the same transformations from one year to one season to the next, year by year, but there are different flavors and different characteristics to from one spring to the next spring, from one winter to the next winter, with the play of all these elements.
So. But it's the same pattern pieces repeat. I mean, we have the same play of patterning, but it's infinite, the variety that you can, you know, it's a different individual. Each year is a different individual year.
Yeah.
But it's the same year over and over again. Mm-hmm. And now we're talking about the the age that we're at, and we're all the same age in this group, which is interesting.
Exactly the same age.
You begin to, at this point, begin to see the life pattern.
Yeah.
And then there's some comfort in that, because that has to be, the life pattern has to be like everything else. So this great fear of death and all of these things, you feel a sense of grace because you know that it's all part of a larger repeating pattern. Mm-hmm. And also, I'll just mention one thing, because this is where you got started, is that I've been having the same experience as you have in my own way. The autumn of our years thing, because but the comparison that I've been making is that autumn is my favorite time of the year. Mm-hmm. I get the most far out feelings and the most complete fulfillment in the autumn days. So, and there's no reason why that can't be the case with my life too.
Well, and that absolutely is the case with my life. I mean, this is the best time of my life so far. Absolutely. It's just in so many ways. And I basically get up every morning and just say thank you, thank you, thank you to life, because it just seems like, you know, there's so much that you struggle with when you're young. Being a teenager, to me, was probably the hardest time of life. There's so many things you take so seriously and are so attached to when you're a teenager and so frustrated by. And then there's all the working years, you know, for me, the motherhood years, and which were wonderful in their own way, but there were many challenges, and the working and career, you know, and all of that stuff. And now it just feels like I was saying before, like harvest time, that all of that work and all of those lessons learned and everything, they're just now able to be expressed in some beautiful, grateful way.
But you watch the teenagers and you watch the middle age and you watch the babies and you watch you're watching your, I mean, from this vantage point, I'm that and I'm, there I am and there I am as that and there I am as that, and what is I? Mm-hmm. That's inside of all of this.
And generates tremendous compassion.
Totally.
For the whole human condition, you know, the older you get, I think, if you remain a person with an open heart, you know, and not, I mean, I think some people, when they get old, become frustrated and bitter and close up. But many people, when they get old, open up more and more. I've often seen a very interesting parallel between older women and little girls, that there are a lot of kind of a resurgence of innocence and playfulness and the kind of less self-consciousness and all that that takes place once a woman gets over a certain age, and loss of beauty is actually part of that. And once you kind of resolve yourself to the loss of your youthful beauty, it's a marvelous thing not to have that pressure and to just be able to be yourself the way you were when you were 9 years old and weren't thinking about those things and you were just a person living life.
This annual cycle that we see is something that is too vast to perceive when you're young. When you're very young, it's like the summer lasts for ages and ages, mm-hmm. and then strangely everything gets different, and then eventually it's Christmas, and then you start thinking about Christmas in the winter and winter time, and as you repeat the cycle more and more, you begin to get familiar with the cycle and familiar with the range of possibilities within the cycle. And it's interesting that this notion of the linear time as opposed to cyclical time, you know, is really a very fundamental cultural quality. Mm-hmm. And it's something that, you know, the people who study archaic societies are especially fascinated by it's the Ouroboros, the snake eating its tail, where the year on a cultural level, is seen as the recapitulation of an archetype year. Mm-hmm. And it's simply the same year every year. And in some small way, we see variations, but those are known to be simply our perception of things, because the reality is the year. The reality is the cycle itself.
So what's so beautiful about that is that it makes past and future always in the present moment.
Right.
So there's no distinction. There's no need to say, I want to get beyond the past, or I want to stop thinking about the future and be in the present moment, because it's all in that timeless state that
right.
we're all three of the same thing.
Yeah, and history implies a certain kind of judgment. You know, it's only interesting if you evaluate it. And that's what leads to a linear sense of time, where every year is different and every event is in a giant sequence. And then you start trying to plot the course and make sure that where you end up is where you're supposed to end up. And in the cyclical world, they don't have to do that. Mm. It doesn't mean that people don't try to perform right action, and that people, you know, don't get, you know, consequences if they do the wrong things, and the people don't learn. But they're learning on this background of the repetition of a cosmic reality, which is a holy reality, instead of on the background of a long scrolling sheet of dates with, you know, mm-hmm. check marks and, you know, annotations all over it, and gold stars where things were going well and black dots where things were not going so well. And that removal of that sense of judgment about whether it was good or bad must be very liberating. And I think as we get older, we begin to see the cycle as a cycle. And that's part of how we begin to step out of historical time into mythic time in our individual lives.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.